If only. Example one, if only I had fewer mistakes in my past, that then probably God would use me for some of his important work in the world, probably then. Example two, if only I was more eloquent of speech, if only I could, you know, use my words better like those people on TV, that then probably God would use me for his work in the world. Example three, if only I had more influence, that then, surely then probably then God would use me for his important work in the world. But if you and I buy into examples 1, 2, and 3, what of Saul? What of Moses? What of Esther, right? Example one, if only I didn't have as many mistakes in my past, then God could use me. Well, what about Saul? He was a persecutor of the church before his conversion. He had blood on his hands. He sought letters of approval to persecute Christians in other communities, and then he became one of the greatest evangelists the world has ever known. Example two, if only I had better words and could speak better and say the right thing at the right time like those other people on TV or online, well, what about Moses, right? Moses, remember, he, you know, at the burning bush, God's there, hey, lead my people, the Hebrews, out of slavery in Egypt. And in chapter 4, Moses says that his tongue is sluggish. I'm not very good at speaking. Don't you want to get someone else? But God chose him and worked through him for just that thing. Example three, if only I had more influence. Well, think of Esther, this woman in this oppressed situation. She gets involved in this entire kind of way of life and world and so many factors beyond her control. But God uses her as a very key instrument to bring about the rescue of the people from slaughter. And so the operative principle in example 1, 2, and 3 is God's ability is bigger than your inability. Right? If we think, okay, all those things are a bigger factor, then really what we're saying is, wait a second, my inability is bigger than God's ability. No, but God's ability is bigger than your inability. And so today's Bible passage will help you see how God can work through you in significant ways, even when you don't think you are qualified. So with that, we are in the Gospel of Mark, and this is our series. We're going line by line, chapter by chapter, through the Gospel, and we kind of put a bit of a pause on it mid-December as we came into Advent and Christmas, but now we are returning to it. And just a couple of reminders. So Jesus has come proclaiming powerfully the kingdom of God. This is where and when God reigns and rules as king. And so he has come, and there's also a clash, and we've seen this clash manifest in a variety of different ways. There's a clash between the kingdom of God and the kingdom of darkness, because Satan has considerable sway in the world, and Satan's like, no, this is my domain. These are my people. This is my territory. And so Jesus is taking back territory, and we see evidence of this clash time and time again as Jesus is preaching, as he is healing, as he's casting out the demonic. And Jesus is inviting disciples to follow him. Chapter 1, I will make you fishers of men and of women. And so he's inviting people to get in on this work in the world, and the crowds are growing, okay? And so here, chapter 6, we're going to pick it up at verse 30, reading from the ESV. The apostles returned to Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. Okay, so basically, what's this a reference to? So way back in chapter 6:12, you know, he had sent them out and they had come back. They were going out to preach and to heal and to cast out demons. And so this is in relationship to that. And he, Jesus, said to them, come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while. For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in the boat to a desolate place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. Okay, so let's pause and note a few things. All these people are there, right? Jesus' popularity is growing, and how does he think about them? Are they an annoyance? No, he has compassion on them. So this is what his heart is like. And why? Well, the reason's told us is because they were like a sheep without a shepherd. And so a couple of things we need to keep in mind. In the Old Testament, God is spoken of as a shepherd who looks after his sheep. Right, so Jesus sees them and he has compassion on them. So I think we're supposed to make the connection, for one. This is how God acts toward his people. And the second thing is we're supposed to see a contrast, I believe. Now, when we left off in mid-December, we talked about John the Baptist and how he was decapitated by the bloody, perverted, treacherous, violent Herod Antipas. Remember that story? And so we did a comparison between the evil King Herod and the good, true king, the noble king, Jesus. We showed how the story was told in such a way that we are to see that intentional contrast, and I think that continues here. How would Herod react to the people? Not like this. And so Jesus sees them. They need a shepherd, and so he has compassion on them. And then we are told that there's a great crowd. So this is the part of the story where the crowds are gathering and they're growing. Now, how big was the crowd? Now, here we're not told, but later we're told that there's 5,000 men, okay? And in Matthew 14, in his version of the story, he says there's also women and children. So let's think of, so if approximately half of the men were married, which would be a conservative estimate, and of those, average of two kids, again, a conservative estimate, we're thinking like 12, 13, 14, 15,000 people. So if you can imagine Scotiabank Arena, where the Raptors play, packed full. That's probably the size of the crowd we are talking about. It's huge, especially when you consider that these are surrounded by, these are little rural villages. So Jesus' home base as an adult is Capernaum. And Capernaum, probably, scholars say, between 800 and 1,200, so maybe 800 people. A big town would be Sepphoris, 15,000 people. So most of these people are from little villages. Imagine all the villages emptying into the surrounding countryside. People, some of them traveling for days, and they've gathered. This is a massive, massive crowd, okay? And he's teaching them. Verse 35, and when it grew late, meaning late in the day, his disciples came to him and said, this is a desolate place, and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. But he answered them, you give them something to eat. We'll come back to that. And they said to him, shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat? And he said to them, how many loaves do you have? Go and see. And when they had found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Okay, a couple of things. They're like, okay, they've been waiting all day and they're hungry, so maybe they should go, maybe dismiss them so they can go get some food. Very natural thing to say and thing to do. But Jesus says, you give them something to eat. Now, of course, we know that the earliest manuscripts are in Greek, and here the word you is in what is called the emphatic position. So if we were typing this out on our computers today, the word you, we'd put it in italics. That is, you give them something to eat. So imagine, okay, so imagine you're there in the Scotiabank Arena, and there's a teacher that you're helping, you're an apprentice, and the teacher's been teaching all day, and these people, they're getting cranky, you know, because the end of the day is here, and they're hungry, and some of them have traveled a long way, and the teacher says, you give them something to eat, and you look around at all these people around you, and you're like, all I got is a bucket of KFC, maybe a box or two of donuts. It's like, and you want us to feed them. Okay. By the way, I did a little bit of math. So here they say even 200 denarii wouldn't be enough. So in modern Canadian funds, that'd be like $100,000. So they're like saying even if we had $100,000, that wouldn't be enough to feed all these people. Side note, I did a little bit of a math here. That would buy a little over 7,100 Big Mac meals from McDonald's. So it's like even that much wouldn't feed all these hungry people. And Jesus says, well, what do you have? And with that, you get a bit of a suggestion that something is in the works here, okay? 5 and 2 fish. Verse 39, then he commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass. Now, this is a little bit of a footnote, okay? I like to highlight these things when they come up. Remember that the Gospel of Mark, this is the eyewitness testimony of the Apostle Peter, chief apostle who walks with Jesus, talks with Jesus. And so he has given these stories and events from Christ to Mark, who has written them down. And there's so many incredible things as you go through, if you're noticing in the Gospel of Mark, that are evidence of eyewitness testimony. Ancient stories were written different as stories today. You didn't tend to include superfluous details, but that's what we find time and time again in the Gospel of Mark. So Jesus is in the boat, and we're told that he was on the cushion at the end of the boat. Sit on the grass. Well, in Mark's gospel, on the green grass. So the reason these details are there is because he's just saying what he remembers experiencing as a firsthand eyewitness, okay? So down on the green grass, verse 40, so they sat down in groups by hundreds and by fifties. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven, said a blessing, and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people, and he divided the 2 fish among them all. And they all ate and were satisfied. Okay, so this is a dramatic miracle of multiplication. Okay, could you just imagine there, the people, right? Think Scotiabank Arena-sized people. And people start passing it out, and it just keeps going and going and going. And imagine the conversations and the exclamations of, what is going on? This is amazing. The teacher is doing this. Could you imagine the miracle and seeing the excitement make the whole place just come alive? And we're told that Jesus, he lifts the bread up before that happens, and he says a blessing. Now, we don't know specifically what he said, but there was a traditional Jewish blessing over bread, right? Some Jews still say today. If Jesus said that traditional blessing, here's what it is. I wrote it in my column here. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the world, who brings forth bread from the earth. Some still say that. So he probably said that. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the world, who brings forth bread from the earth. And then also, this kind of reminds us of something else, right? It's kind of like communion, the Lord's Supper, breaking the bread. So this is a foreshadowing of that. So in John 6:35, Jesus says, I am the bread of life. So the bread of life who sustains us and nourishes us spiritually here also does it physically. And I think this is a foreshadowing of communion, that sacrament that he gives to us. Verse 43, and they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. There's leftovers. They end up with more than they started with. And those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men. Of course, as we also talked about before from Matthew 14, plus women and children, it's a huge group. As I was doing my research for this, one of the things that came to mind right at this point as the story comes to a conclusion is Psalm 23. Right, one of the most famous passages in the Bible, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Here, Jesus has compassion on them. He says they're like sheep without a shepherd. He is the shepherd. He teaches them. He feeds them spiritually. Then he feeds them physically. This is a fulfillment of Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. Jesus himself calls himself the good shepherd in John 10:9. And then here, we just see it play out in a beautiful way. I shall not want. I have everything I need. Jesus provides. And so we end our look at the text there. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Okay, 2 insights flowing from the text. And the first is this. Jesus is the new and greater Moses. Now, as I explain this, I just want to say and acknowledge that to us, this isn't that big of a deal. To many Christians today, right? We believe that Jesus is the Messiah. He's the Son of God. He's the Lord come to us in human flesh. All we believe this, right? And so to us, this isn't that big of a deal, but you have to get into the mind of those first apostles and disciples and followers, right? Because the big heroes of the faith are Abraham and Moses and David. To suggest that someone was a new and greater Moses was a very big deal. It would have been mind-blowing to people, but this is one of the functions of the story, and this is how it happens. So, Moses, called by God to lead the Hebrews from slavery, in the wilderness. They go into the wilderness. Well, today's story, we are told 3 times that it happens in a desolate place, verse 31, 32, 35. The Greek word translated here for desolate place could also be translated as wilderness. Okay, that's interesting. Well, in the Hebrew wilderness, God provided them with manna from heaven, right? Kind of a bready, flaky substance with a honey flavor, right? It's a bread-like substance. Here, Jesus feeds them with bread in the wilderness. Way back in the Hebrew wilderness, they had enough for just 1 day at a time, sometimes 2 to cover the Sabbath, but just enough for that day. Here, Jesus not only does that, but gives them more. There's 12 baskets left over. Speaking of 12, in the Old Testament, 12 is a number that makes us think of all the people of God. There's 12 tribes of Israel. So here there are 12 baskets left over. Is this a coincidence, or are we being taught that Jesus provides an abundance for the whole people of God? Okay, back to Moses. There's 5 books of Moses in the Old Testament: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Is it a coincidence here that there's 5 loaves, that there's 5,000 men? I think what's happening on multiple levels is we're being taught that Jesus is the new and greater Moses. So again, to us today, we're like, okay, we probably don't need convincing, but this would have been very, very important for that early community to know the significance of Jesus. The second point is this, and this is really where we're going to focus our application, that God uses what you have, not what you wish you had. Okay, so as you think about your role in the world, if only. Now, let's unpack this a little bit. God uses what you have, not what you wish you had. So the disciples, okay, a certain wow factor had developed in the minds of the apostles and the disciples as they were following Jesus, right? Chapter 1, he calls them, I will make you fishers of men, people, etc. Get in on this work. He proclaims the kingdom of God. He's confronting hypocrisy. He's healing people. He's raised a little 12-year-old girl from the dead, for goodness sakes. He is rebuking the wind and the storm like someone would cast out a demon. He does that too. He's doing all these incredible things. And so there's a temptation to just sit back and watch the Jesus show. Wow, isn't this amazing, right? But Jesus has called them to get involved in his work, and he's continually drawing them. Again, this is about me, but this is also about you. So he's moving them from observation to participation. Observation to participation. And we see this really coming through verse 37. You give them something to eat. You give them something to eat. Like, well, we only have a little bit. Well, what do you have? 5 loaves, 2 fish. Hand it over. Now, here's another layer. Mark's gospel is written in such a way that certain key themes are meant for us specifically. One of them is discipleship, so the disciples and our discipleship today. It's written in such a way that we are to identify with those disciples. We are to see ourselves in them. Their insights should be our insights. The times they stumble, we see ourselves in them, etc. And so with what they learn, we are to learn as well. And this is where we get to our if only problem. If only I didn't have so many problems in my past. If only I was more eloquent of speech. If only I had more influence in the world, that then maybe God would use me for great things in the world. The if only for the apostles was 5 loaves, 2 fish. What is your if only? What are your loaves and fishes that you think is probably not enough for God to use, but he knows better? If only I was stronger. Let me just speculate some of the thoughts that might be in your mind over the ages. If only I was stronger, if I was only a stronger person, yeah, then probably God might use me for something great in the world, or something that he thinks is important. If only I was smarter. There's some smart people. If only I was smarter and I knew those answers like some other people, then probably God would use me for his important work in the world. If only I was less busy. Yeah, that's it. If only I was less busy, then maybe God might use me for something. If only I had more faith. Man, I don't know. I'm not sure about this, that, and the other thing. Maybe if I only had more faith, then you know, God might use me for some of his work in the world. If only I was just not so normal. Special about me? I'm kind of the person that blends in. I don't have anything unique. What we're forgetting is that operative principle that God's ability is bigger than your inability. So God uses what you have, not what you wish you had. Let's spend a few minutes thinking about what you do have. Okay, what do you have? You have faith. That's the biggest thing. That is the biggest thing. Did you realize that the book of Hebrews says you cannot please God if you don't have faith? It is the biggest thing. It is so high, we can take it for granted, and all these other things are down here. Faith. What else do you have? You have prayer. God works through prayer time and time again. God is near to the one who calls on him in truth, Psalm 145. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you, James 4. This comes up time and time. You have faith, you have prayer, you have skills and abilities. You think, okay, my skill or my ability that I have is not special, not important. Who cares? Do you think because there's another electrician in the city of Barrie that there doesn't need to be another electrician? No, God uses all kinds of skills that many people have in many different situations. You have a distinct set of relationships that other people don't have. God has put you in those. That's unique to you. God has put you in certain moments with certain people that other people don't have access to. He's given them to you. Not only that, but every Christian has at least one spiritual gift. This is a God-ordained place of power that the Spirit works through you in your life. Now, if you're not sure what your spiritual gift is, we've talked about this. We spent a couple Sundays on it last year. Get in touch. I'll send you the formula. I'll send you the kind of the steps. I'll send you some of those resources and listing of the gifts. You have things. Now, let's not lose sight of the most important word in that sentence. Let's circle it with our little yellow marker. God uses what you have, not what you wish you had. See, it's not you doing it. It's Him doing it. God's ability is bigger than your inability. And so the disciples had 5 loaves and 2 fish. Their job was to hand it over, and with whatever your version, your kind of loaves and fish are, your job is the same. It's to hand it over. Mark Batterson has this great saying in his book, Chase the Lion. He says, if you do little things like they're big things, God will do big things like they're little things. If you do little things, these are the little things, these are your loaves and fishes types of things. This is the encouragement, this is the support, this is being faithful into the situations in which God puts you. You do little things as if they are big things, meaning you recognize that God is God and He can do whatever with whatever. If you do little things like they're big things, God will do big things like they're little things. Why? Because He's sovereign and He is God. Let me just end with this thought. J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, obviously a well-known writer, in one of his short stories, lesser known, and some of his other works, there's this little character named Niggle. And Niggle is an artist, and Niggle wants to do this great, you know, a nature scene with this trees and vistas and like mountains and valleys in the background. But he's focused on this one leaf, and he can't quite get it right, and he keeps working on this one single leaf, and he never moves beyond that because he just wants to focus on this. But Niggle gets sick, and Niggle dies before anything else happens. Well, Andy Bannister explains the significance. Niggle so desperately wants his picture to be perfect that he never finishes more than one leaf on the tree, endlessly obsessing over getting it right. After his death, Niggle arrives in heaven. Where he approaches the edge of the heavenly country, he sees a tree, not just any tree, but his tree, finished and complete, every leaf perfect. Christianity says that we're all like Niggle, that we can make a difference if our efforts, our energy, our work are caught up in and with and are a part of God's greater purposes. Then our strivings cannot merely outlive us, but be revealed as a part of something bigger, beautiful, more real, the kingdom that God is building for eternity. If you do little things like they're big things, God will do big things like they're little things. And so what is your version of the 5 loaves and 2 fish handed over? Because God uses what you have, not what you wish you had. Praise be to God.